Welcome to the podcast, Think Biblically, Conversations on Faith and Culture. I'm your host, Sean McDowell, Professor of Apologetics at Talbot School of Theology, Biola University. We have a guest today that I can't believe we have not had on yet, even though we've been doing this podcast a year and a half, have wanted to have our guest on for a long time. One of the leading apologists today, a friend, mentor of mine, huge friend of Biola. In fact, you teach with me. That's adjunct right. at the apologetics program at
That's
Talbot.
That's right. I spent many years there as a master's candidate in the MA Phil program, too. Too many years, probably. 13.
We had classes together.
We did.
In the early 2000s. Now, in case you don't recognize his voice yet, this is Greg Kokel, is my guest. And you might recognize his voice because he's the president of Standard Reason and has a long-going radio show now, a podcast that is one of the best apologetic podcasts that are out there. So if you haven't listened to his yet, hit pause, go to Standard Reason, subscribe to it.
Yeah.
Regardless.
STR.org.
STR.org. Regardless of that, Greg, thanks for coming on.
Sure. Yeah, it's always a treat to chat with you. Sure.
Now, we could talk about your book, Tactics, which you talk about how you have practical conversations with people about the faith. We could talk about relativism, your more recent book, The Story of Reality. You get calls every week, and you can wrestle with a number of issues, theologically, ethically, culturally. I want to kind of peer behind the curtain a little bit and just give our listeners a sense of who you are, your journey of faith, and some life stories you've learned along the way.
Okay.
So maybe just start by telling us, you weren't raised in a Christian family.
No, I was actually raised in a Roman Catholic family, but like a lot of, in the 50s, I was born in 1950, and so I went to high school and began college in the 60s in that turbulent time. When I was about a senior, that's when I kind of let go of whatever religious trappings that I had from
senior
the
senior high school.
Senior in high school, that's right. And, of course, when you're 18 in the 60s, the mid-60s, the last thing you want to think about is, you know, purity and religion and God looking over your shoulder. I guess it's the same nowadays, too. But
probably
the things
true.
That were happening in the culture were pretty monumental then, a lot of shifting and changing. And so I embraced the thought forms of the day, which were relativistic. I was against the war in Vietnam. I was actually in the Army at the time, but I was still against the war in Vietnam, which everybody was who was in college. It was part of the, it wasn't thoughtful, but it was just what everybody did. You know, when you're a certain set, like in college, everybody, it's group think kind of deal.
Yep.
But it wasn't until a few years later, into the early 70s, that my younger brother, who was more the jock of the family, the boys, you know, we were all in sports, but he was the one was most accomplished. But he ended up becoming a Jesus follower during the Jesus movement.
And yeah.
I was very dismissive of it at first because I thought I was too smart for that. And I was the only one of the five children to go to college. And I was in an honors program at Michigan State University at the time. And it was so I figured, you know, I've got this all worked out. I don't need this Jesus stuff. But as it turned out, I ended up moving to the West Coast. And my brother Mark was out here at the same time in the 1973-ish. And that's when he really turned on the heat. And what I think is important about this, there's a couple of things I just wanted to point out. I'm rushing through just a little bit, but I want to hit some points that I think your listeners would care about. And one of them is it was my younger brother who led me to Christ.
Wow.
So family circumstances sometimes are tough. And oftentimes it's an outsider that gets at a family member you care about because they don't respect you and your testimony. So I understand there's difficulty there. But in my case, it turned out that Mark was the one that not only led me to Christ, but was instrumental in leading every member of our family to every sibling, at least all four of the others over time.
Wow.
Took a while. So that's one thing. Second thing, what I think unique for people who do what we do is that a lot of our colleagues, J. Warner Wallace, for example, you know, and starts out an atheist and then he examines the evidence and the apologetics are instrumental. Same thing with your dad, to bringing them to Christ. There was no role of apologetics in my life in coming to Christ.
Wow. I did not know that.
Yeah. It was not an issue. It was soon after, of course, I discovered evidence and read Francis Schaeffer and C.S. Lewis. And but for me in that circumstance, even though I had objections to Christianity, the standard things that people raise up, it wasn't that brought me to Christ. All I could say is Mark prevailed upon me with the gospel, explaining the gospel and being a Roman Catholic. There was a detail there that that is something I had no access to as a Roman Catholic, and that is confidence of salvation. You can't know you're saved, not on their view, because who could know that? You know, it strikes me now when I look back on it, how could that possibly be good news then if you have no idea what's going to happen to you when you're dead? It's good news because there's confidence we can have. And this was something I hadn't heard, forgiveness. One-time final, there it is. You trust Christ and you're covered. And I don't mean to speak frivolously of that. I mean to speak confidently of it. He secures you. He does what's necessary to rescue. One sacrifice for all time. He has sanctified those who believe. You know, it's Hebrews 10 stuff. So that just all settled in. And I had never heard the gospel of grace and forgiveness like that before. And I think over time, that just wore me down. And then I told my brother, he came to visit me once, and I said, "You don't have to tell me anymore. I'm ready to become a Christian." And I have a suspicion that I'd probably actually de facto been born again just before that night that I prayed. I'm not sure how that works in God's whole thing, but I did say a prayer on September 28, 1973. And that's when I formally, in a sense, started walking with Christ.
So what advice do you have for Christians with family members who are not to navigate the truth in the gospel and relationships?
Well, in a way, it's not super profound. The first thing is be nice.
That's great. Today, that's profound.
Be nice. I mean, you want to be really careful. I know when we started out, my brother Dave, who's 4 years my junior, Mark is 2 years younger than me, that we all started, in a sense, walking with the Lord. Dave came out to California, the three Kokel brothers were all together there, just 4 years apart, all three of us. And so it was kind of, and we were all fairly new in Christ and we're really excited. But we ended up walking on a lot of people, you know, especially me, because I was so energetic and ambitious and, you know, just overflowing with. So I think just settle down and relax. And you've got a lifetime, really, with your family members, realistically speaking. My dad was a really tough guy, and he ended up becoming Christian 2 years before he died at 71 years old.
Wow.
Almost, he just turned 72. And he was very dismissive of the boys when we became Christians, very dismissive of it. And but he ended up becoming a Christian because of the influence of his older sister, my aunt, Bernie, in his life. So in that situation, it wasn't a family member who brought my dad in, not our family, it was his sister that was really most instrumental. And that's a whole nother story. But so what was important for us, and I don't know how good we did this, but looking back at it, is to just be nice, to be good, to be good examples of Christians and followers of Christ, but also be ready to give an answer, to make a defense, to even explain the gospel in terms that people can understand.
So if apologetics played essentially zero role in your faith conversion, what's your passion to doing apologetics and starting this ministry, Stand to Reason, which equips Christians, but also equips Christians to have conversations with non-believers? So it's discipleship and evangelism.
Yeah.
Where does that passion come from?
Well, two things happened early on. I became a Christian in September 73 February 74, I moved into a Christian community in Westwood Village. And that, well, there were people that
What does that mean, Christian community?
Okay, it was a fraternity house that had been changed into a Christian community. There was a school called the Jesus Christ Light and Power House, kind of a corny name.
Yeah.
But one of the, and they were a bunch of guys basically who had all left Bill Bright's Campus Crusade at the same time, you know, they started their own thing. So these guys had a lot of experience on campus. Most of them were DTS grads, and they're sharp people, but they also had street smarts. And one of them was Dick Day, who was as instrumental in discipling your dad.
That's right.
Way back when. And I entered into a discipleship relationship very soon with a fellow named Craig Englert, who has now been pastoring 30 years in Maui, but he had been instrumental in the Jesus movement there. And so here I am in this environment, living in this community with learning the Bible. You know, we had Bible classes all morning, and then we had afternoons free, take a job or do whatever we do. But it was really a magnificent experience. I was 23 years old. I was a brand new Christian, and with Christians all around me, investing in me in these classes and stuff, then spending a lot of personal time with Craig Englert. And I think that's when I really began to It's his personal investment that made such a difference in setting the trajectory on my life and gave me this deep commitment to discipleship. And over the years, you know, having groups that I'd spend direct time with as a group, maybe for a year or something. Other times, just individuals that I traffic with, you know, I try to encourage. And I realized, and it wasn't really until probably 3 or 4 years ago, Sean, now it's almost 26 years would stand to reason, but I realized reflectively now that what Stand to Reason is about is principally about discipleship. Because our mission statement from very early on starts out, we train Christians. In other words, we're working with believers. We're not evangelistic. We're not like Ravi Zacharias or other organizations, Crusade, a lot of discipleship, a lot of evangelism too. My interest was in building the body of Christ, because I figured if I can build individual Christians, that could leverage my impact in an evangelistic way. Sometimes this may sound strange to you. I don't know if I've ever talked to you about this, but people imagine things about you, so then they work them into the introductions. And so people would say, and here's Greg Kokel, and he's got such a heart for the lost. You know, he'll say something like this. It's very sweet and everything, but I would never characterize myself that way.
Interesting.
I wouldn't say that I have a heart for the lost. I have a heart for the body of Christ and for discipleship. And that's kind of where my niche is. And of course, this is all part of the larger project of God working to build the kingdom of God, which includes bringing the lost in and glorifying, you know, all kinds of other things. But I like the building of Christians. The apologetic stuff started out for me twofold. First of all, when I became a Christian, there was a lot of evangelism, because I'm on the streets of Westwood Village there, where UCLA is at. I was a student there at the time. And all kinds of crazy things are going on in the early 70s, spiritually speaking. Everybody's talking about their trip on the street, so I'm in the action too, and I got to figure out ways to make sense of my own view. I get asked questions, I got to answer. So this is what got me interested. Plus, that first community, there was a lot of emphasis on apologetics because of Dick's role with your dad. I mean, that whole thing there. And I actually saw your dad speak at UCLA when I was...
Oh, my goodness.
Yeah, it's so amazing, because that's last night your dad went first and I went second.
That's
on the same stage, you know, in this event we're at right now. But I don't think he even knows that. But 45 years ago at UCLA, I went to an event and saw him do a presentation at UCLA and answer questions and everything. It was really amazing. But so I need this for conversing with other people, but it also is something that really built my own conviction stronger and stronger and stronger.
Gotcha.
And one of my main people that I read was deeply influenced by was Francis Schaeffer. And I remember, I can even picture it in my mind's eye, sitting at my desk there in that old fraternity house, looking out over Westwood Village, you know, through the window, and I'm reading Francis Schaeffer, and it's something powerful. And what I was thinking is, oh my gosh, this stuff is really, really, really true. You know, that's what I said to myself. Now, I was a follower of Christ. I moved into this community. I mean, but there was a much deeper sense of conviction, confidence that took hold of my heart.
Was it like
as a result
personally
of,
true to like cosmically true?
Yeah,
like
yeah,
I
something
see
like
it
true
in
truth
ways that I...
What Schaeffer used to call true truth. You
that's
know?
Right.
And... And I don't know, it wasn't as if I was thinking merely subjectively about the truthfulness. Okay,
sure.
Now I'm in my club here. I'm out there going face to face with people who don't like this message at all. So I'm paying a price because I think it's actually so. So it wasn't like I was going from subjective to objective. The only way I could explain it is, though I thought it was objectively true, maybe I was taking a step from believing to knowing. In other words, I have enough confidence that it's so, that I believe it's so, that I can step out. But you know how you get more information about something and then, you know, more justification for you?
Yep.
Then it starts to move into the knowledge, okay, this is really, okay, I know this is the case for these reasons. And this is what apologetics really helped me.
So you felt that in your life and thought, I want to help the rest of the church really have this power to live their life, do their profession, do evangelism from within the church.
Yeah, I don't
that
know
fair?
That it was... I think what you're saying is true, but I don't think it was... I thought it through very much early on. What I did want to do is I wanted to bloom where I was planted is the words that I use now.
Yep.
I wanted to make a difference for Christ where I was at.
Okay.
And I remember I was probably a year, not even a year old in the Lord, and I remember telling my discipler, Craig, that I don't ever want to have any secular job ever in my life. I want to just keep working for the kingdom. Now, I laugh at this because it took me about 10 or 12 years to end up getting out of secular work of some sort.
And right,
work,
right.
And it's that wasn't God's purpose for me. Sovereignly,
sure.
He needed to know he knew that I needed to get my butt kicked up down the street for a decade before I was going to be very useful to him.
Mm.
Okay. And that's another important part of the process,
yep.
You know. But that was my sentiment. And what was I going to do? Well, I can use the gifts that I have. So I had no broad vision at all.
Gotcha.
But it's only now as I look back, and like I said, only in the last 3 or 4 years that I've been thinking, yeah, you know, I have been committed to discipleship for most of my life. This is why I've had these different groups of people, and this is why I know about that. And now I think about what Stand to Reason has been is really a big effort of
that
discipleship to train Christians. And even our vision now is confidence for every Christian. Confidence for every.
That makes
I mean,
sense.
One part of a 3-part vision. Confidence for every Christian, clear thinking for every challenge, and courage and grace for every encounter.
Mm.
So, but that confidence for every Christian, that goes right back to when I was sitting there reading Francis Schaeffer, you
wow.
know?
Wow.
That really helped me. And so, again, it's easier to kind of tease these things out when you look back over a lifetime
yep.
of these things happening. But for me, I didn't have a big, giant plan. I just was kind of following my nose, the next step. Well, what can I do? Here, I can do this, I can do that.
So is this true for tactics as well? Because I think one of the, I think, most powerful contributions that you make on your podcast, when I listen to it, and I still do, by the way,
you.
Is I'm not always listening to what you're saying. I'm listening to how you think through and answer and unpack a question, all the assumption behind it,
yeah.
so people make sure they grasp, here's how you arrived at this
here's how it works.
Answer.
Yeah, yeah.
Is this just an extension of the way you're wired? Where
yeah,
does this come from? Because you really clarified
question.
It in the book Tactics.
Mm-hmm.
And it's one of the most helpful must-read books for Christians
you.
To learn how to navigate spiritual conversations. A lot of people don't approach it that way. Is it just your wiring, spiritual gift,
you know,
experience?
To me, I don't even divide it out that I think spiritual gifts and natural gifts are both things from God, and He uses our experiences. He's sovereign in my life before I even became a follower of Jesus and all that. So I think that all kind of blends together.
Sure.
I wanted people not just to get right answers, and this is part of Stand to Reason. You've probably heard this before. We don't want to just tell people what to think. We want to teach them how to think.
Exactly.
And so by stepping through the process of how I get there, it then shows people how that thinking process works. And to some degree, I think there's some native capabilities here that have helped. But I was helped tremendously by people like J.P. Moreland and the M.A. Phil program. I got a master's in apologetics first, and then I went and I kind of made reference to it a few moments ago. I was 13 years in that M.A. program, which you're probably not supposed to be in it that long, but we were bringing lots of the people into the program and out of the program at the same time. So they had a lot of patience with me as we were doing Stand to Reason while I was working on that. But that whole enterprise with JP and Doug and Guy Vitt and Scott Ray and the whole crowd, the team, our family, our colleagues over there really helped me in the process of thinking how to make distinctions and how to tease out things that really are important to keep us from being confused. So that added to my, in a sense, skill set.
It makes sense.
And this allowed me then to be more almost pedantic about it when I'm talking. We can say, no, we're going from here to here
yep.
to here to here.
Yep.
But my experience has been by stepping carefully through those things, it becomes another discipleship or mentoring of the people that are listening.
It definitely is. So you've done radio how many years now?
I'm in my 29th year.
29th year. So
yeah.
I don't know if you've ever gone back and tabulated how much time that is or roughly how many questions you've been asked. That would kind of be interesting to estimate.
Yeah.
But what are the hardest questions? It could be emotionally, experientially, intellectually. Like, what are those questions where you just feel like, this is the least satisfying answer I have. Doesn't make me question Christianity because of everything else.
Right.
But are there one or two where you go,
these are just tough questions? And I'm candid about this on the air. I think that the hardest issues, generally speaking, are theological and they're not apologetics. And for all the kinds of challenges people might raise apologetically regarding the Bible or God's existence or any of those kinds of things, there's always a question in the back of my mind. And the question in the back of my mind is, what's the alternative? Because you can't sit in the fence when it comes to worldviews. You're either one place or another. And I know people are sometimes uncertain, that's agnostic about particular things. But the point I'm making is, if you reject Christianity as an adequate picture of reality or view of the way the world actually is, that characterization of reality, then you have to adopt something else. And the whatever else that you adopt is going to be a whole lot messier than Christianity, because Christianity does the best job it's the best explanation for the way things are, I think, is the way I put it to my daughter once. So those particular, there are problems that people raise, and some things I'm much more comfortable with than other things. I think Old Testament stuff, even yesterday when you were answering, it was Wednesday night at my church.
That's right.
So here we are in Seattle, but we're also together in LA a couple
For listeners, we're at an apologetics conference together, recording this on the road.
That's right.
In Bellevue. Right. So
and 3 days ago, we were at another conference where I was in the audience, and it was my church. And Sean was talking. But I think trying to validate the Old Testament kind of independently is hard because of the antiquity of it.
Yep.
But I think your approach was validating the New Testament, and that validates Jesus. And then we look at what Jesus' view of the Old Testament was. And so I think there's a legitimate thing, too, there. And I think your dad said something. I took notes of this last night. I'd never heard this before. How do we know that the prophecies that were fulfilled in the life of Christ antedated him? I'd always gone back to the Dead Sea Scrolls because we have a lot of that in Isaiah and we know the dates of that and everything. He said we have the Septuagint, which is 200 years before the time of Christ, the Greek Old Testament recording all of that. Huh. I thought, oh man, that's fabulous. That's so those are ways to argue that, but that is a little less tidy, I think, than what we'd like. The New Testament we can do a lot more with. So that, I think, is a little bit troublesome. I think the harder ones, though, that the theological ones are, is the difficulty for me of the concept of original sin and our responsibility for the sin that someone else committed, Adam and Eve, and how we participate in that. It just came up on the radio for me last week, yes. I think. And there are two classical answers. You know, we were in Adam, and so we participated. That's one way. Or that he was the federal head, and he was acting for the human race, which is the view that I hold and is in the book, The Story of Reality. But I think both of those are not emotionally satisfying for me. And I've said this before. So one of the things, though, this is a subtext here, I want Christians to feel comfortable with saying that there are things about what they know about God and the Bible that are not tidy, that may not be satisfying, and that we don't know the answers for. This isn't a problem with Christianity. This is a problem with being human. This is a problem with reality. Everything's untidy. Every view is untidy in some ways. We have limits in our ability to know, and we have all kinds of other things that are going on, biases and stuff that influence it. So we shouldn't be surprised when we run into things that are a little bit troublesome.
I love that, especially coming from you, one of the people I look to for answers frequently. That's encouraging to me, and I know both of us saying that can be meaningful. That's a part of life.
Yeah.
So what motivates you? And by that, I mean, you've had Stand to Reason, I think you said 26 years.
In three or four days, it'll be 26 years.
26 years. So by the time people listen to this, it'll be 26 years.
Yeah, that's right.
And you continue to write, continue to speak. I heard my dad say something on stage. He's done this almost 5 decades with Crew. And he said, you know what still motivates me is I think about the people that my grandkids are going to marry someday if they get married. And I thought, oh my goodness, like I hadn't put myself at that stage. Sure. What continues to motivate him?
Sure.
So you don't have to have a deep answer like that. That was my point. But what still wakes you up? What gets you excited? What motivates you to keep doing what you're doing?
Well, I'll tell you what comes to mind, and this has come to mind many times for me. And it's just the words, well done, good and faithful servant. That's it. I just want to hear that. You know, I want my Father in heaven to say that to me. I want to finish the course. I want to take the things, whatever they have, that I have that have been entrusted to me. Paul tells Timothy in 2 Timothy chapter 1, guard that which has been entrusted to you. Okay, so I feel that this baton has been passed to me, it's been entrusted to me. I want to carry it well for as long as I can carry it. Then I'll pass it on to somebody else and then go be with the Lord. So I don't think about, you know, all these people getting saved. That's God's business. He cares more about it than I do. You know, I want to have an impact in somebody's life. So if I can have an impact in someone's life and they pay it forward, that's the best compliment that I could be given. I don't need all kind of strokes and stuff, you know, and I probably get more attention than I deserve or is good for me already. But one nice thing about radio is you don't have a big audience in front of you. You're just doing your thing, and then you let God take care of it from there, just like we're doing now. And then He multiplies it, kind of like loaves and fishes. You know, it just goes out there and feeds the multitudes. And I'm glad. And sometimes people tell me, you know, generations removed from me, how God has used that in their life. When I say generations, I mean spiritual generations. The reverberating effect of that. But but the thing that I just want to be faithful. I just want to just keep doing it. It's the only thing I can really control.
I love it.
I can't control how many people whose lives I change. I can't control. I can't even control if my kids are happy with me, you know, or my wife with me, you know. Anybody's happy for that matter, even the ones closest to me. What I can control is what I do. And I work hard to try to be faithful with that.
We had Os Guinness on a few episodes back, and he said the idea of legacy is a secular idea. Christians should be motivated by hearing the words, "Well done, good and faithful servant." He said the same thing, and that really stuck with me.
Yeah, I call it an audience of one. And that's actually wrote recently on it with some material that's going out for Stand to Reason. But like I was saying before, you can't guarantee that people are going to be happy with you. You can't play for the crowd. You know who played for the crowd? Pilate played for the crowd. Played for them. Mark 15:15, seeking to satisfy the crowd, he released Barabbas and had Jesus scourged and crucified. That's what it says. I don't want to be on his team.
That's a great answer. We have time for maybe one or two more, but I'm curious. You've been doing this longer than I have. How have the questions people are asking changed in the time you've been doing evangelism, apologetics, radio? And what are the big questions, or you see where this is going?
See, I'm going to give a different answer than some people. For one, it isn't like I'm on the line answering non-Christians' questions all the time.
Sure.
Okay. So that's one, just so people know. I answer a lot of questions on the radio, but most of the time they're Christians who are navigating with non-Christians. The second thing is, and this is deeply influenced by Francis Schaeffer, human beings are still human beings. They're made in the image of God, and they have to live in the world that God made. I think you mentioned this last night in one of your presentations. This is a reality of it, and this helps stabilize me. It keeps me from being tossed to and fro with every wind and wave of culture.
Yeah.
You know, oh, which generation is this now? We just had Z. We just ran out of letters. I don't know where we're going to go next. See, I don't give a lot of thought to that. This is something that you're much better at. And Brett Kunkel, for example, John Stone Street, and you're traffic more in those trendy things. I can't keep up with all of that, basically. And so my thinking is, human beings are still, they have this existential need. They know they're broken. They know they're sinful. They know the world's broken. And they still have the same kinds of objections. The postmodern thing is a veneer. Everybody is a modern, everybody really deep down in their heart is a common sense realist. That is, they know there is truth in the world. We are truth seekers by nature. But when it comes to certain claims about ultimate reality, Christianity, for example, religious, spiritual things, then people have pushbacks. And that's why they ask questions. And you know this as well as I do, even with all the postmodern noise out there, it's unanswered questions that are keeping a lot of people from young people, especially from Christianity. So in a certain sense, that task hasn't changed too much. There are some new boutique things going on with the gender issues and all of that, you know, but this too shall pass and it'll be something else. What's being expressed there are two things, I think, is a deep hunger for significance and acceptance, but also a deep desire to be autonomous. So you got a hunger for being part of God's family and also a desire to be your own person. And those things are fighting each other, of course. And those are all part of what it means to be human in a broken and fallen world.
It's a great answer. When I do a talk on Gen Z, I talk about the studies and trends and beliefs. But I always begin by saying these stats are only going to take us so far. And then I'll say second, I'll say, and keep in mind, you have much more in common with this generation than you do differences. Human nature transcends, you know, individual trends that are going
That's
on.
Right. Right.
Now, there's timely questions, that questions like certain gender questions seem to really be timely now. But then there's timeless questions that will never, ever change.
Well, just to give you an example of this, I don't know how often you go on Amazon and see where your book's rated. Every once in a while, I take a look at the
numbering. I want to know.
That's right. So you look at the, you know, the top apologetics books and something. You look at the top 10, and I guarantee you, no matter when you check it, one author will have at least three titles in there.
C.S. Lewis.
C.S. Lewis.
Yep.
Okay. What, Mere Christianity was written in like the year I was born. 1950 or right around 51.
I thought it was the 40s. I didn't think you
were
that
old. Did the radio shows in the 40s, but I think it was published in 51, so I got you there.
Okay.
But you're right. See, this is like 70 years ago, and this guy is still pounding them off right there at the top of the list in apologetics. Like, he didn't know postmodern from what, you know? He didn't know gender, this, that, and the other thing. But the guy understands the truth, and he's able to communicate it in an attractive, insightful fashion. And so
he
survived the test of time, and people are still being transformed by what God's doing in him.
Great, that's a great word. I had so many more questions I want to ask you about your book, Relativism, which you wrote roughly two decades ago, right?
Yeah, it was 1998, so 98. A little more than 2 days with
it's
Dr. Frank Beckwith.
Still
right?
So timely.
Yeah,
your book, Tactics, our listeners, if they haven't got it, need to pick it up. And more recently, maybe we'll have you back on to talk about the story of reality.
Yeah, I'd like to do both, actually, come back on Tactics, because in November, revised and expanded edition, 40% new material, is coming out. So I'm really excited about the Tactics.
We'll have you back and we'll walk through the particulars of that in the update. I'll look forward to it. Thanks so much for coming on.
Great talking with you, Sean.
This has been an episode of the podcast Think Biblically, conversations on faith and culture. To learn more about us and today's guest, Greg Kokel, and to find more episodes, go to biola.edu/thinkbiblically. That's biola.edu/thinkbiblically. If you enjoyed today's conversation, give us a rating on your podcast app and share it with a friend. Thanks for listening, and remember, think biblically about everything.